Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice-monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. My dog Minton ate all my shuttlecocks.
Wait. Oh, he's a badminton.
He's a badminton. Yes.
I don't know why.
That was too obvious, but I liked it. I liked it.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician on our 500th episode, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm good, Paul. It's been 500 and it feels like it's barely been five.
I have aged so much. I'm so tired.
We're in our 10th year. 10th yeah. Anniversary is coming up in early 2026. But Paul, we've done it. We have a real treat tonight because we're talking about COPD. We've done, we're going to go over the latest guidelines and some of the latest recommendations and therapies in COPD with a fantastic pulmonologist, Dr. Cyrus Askin, who he has been a curbsider. We talk about it since he was a second year medical resident. Almost the whole time we did curbsiders, he kind of joined at the end of our 1.5 years, like at the end of our second year, I guess, in 2016.
Early, yeah.
So yeah, it was early. So Paul, what is it we do on the show? And then let's introduce our co-host and we can chat a little more.
Sure. Matt, we are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. As you mentioned, we are joined by frequent producer, frequent co-host, Wunderkind, Dr. Paul Wirtz. Dr. Wirtz, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Yeah. And Paul Wirtz, what is this? Is this year two for you or year three, I think?
You have to think about this, but I just started year three. So almost done.
Yeah. And you have done great. We now classify you as super producer Wunderkind, as Paul was saying. This is our 500th episode. We have so much to get to on this that we are going to have a companion episode where Dr. Paul Williams and I are going to be answering some listener questions from our patrons. It'll probably be out on both the main feed and the Patreon feed, but we'll be answering some AMA-style questions, some clinical, some not. But we want to do something special for 500, so we're acknowledging it here, but this will just be a normal episode. So with that, Dr. Wirtz, would you tell people about our guest and then we can get on with the interview?
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Askin, per usual. He is a longtime beloved member of the Curbsiders family and current pulmonary and critical care doctor. Cyrus continues to serve as an internal medicine associate program director at an academic medical program in El Paso, Texas. He is also the medical director of their intensive care unit and associate professor of medicine of the Uniform Services University. He's also the co-founder for Critical Care Time, an intensive care podcast, where he and his co-host dive into the high-stakes world of critical care medicine and discuss all things critical care. In this episode, he takes us on a tour through COPD with a focus on what's new in the world of chronic obstructive lung disease. So without further ado, let's get to it.
A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Cyrus, welcome back to the show. And we were just talking about this. You and I both met. I was in the Air Force, you were in the Army, but it was a friendly relationship despite the different branches of the service. And this was like 9 years ago. I think you're right. I think it was around 2016. You were like our first Curbsiders correspondent. We were trying to go The Daily Show has their correspondents. We had Curbsiders correspondents, and we now have had like, I don't know, 50 plus correspondents. But Most of them have stayed with us, some since 2016, like you, some since 2017. Like, so we've had a lot of people that have been with us for a long time. But you started as a resident. You stayed through your whole training, fellowship, everything. Now you're back on as a specialist. And I think COPD might have been one of the first, or asthma might have been one of the first episodes. Now you've been kind of an expert on both. So that's pretty cool for us. As we're at our 500th episode, we've been around long enough, Paul, that kind of stuff is happening on the regular now.
Yeah, I disapprove of all of this.
That's me too, actually.
And Cyrus, did you... hobbies or interest outside of medicine, do you have time for anything? You're wearing your Critical Care Time shirt, which is your own podcast. Do you have time for anything outside of medicine?
I mean, I've got a lovely family, super supportive wife. My two boys, Liam is 4.5 and Reese is like 7-8 months now. We're orchestrating a move back to San Antonio, which is super exciting for us. And really outside of that, still try to hit the gym as often as I can and just kind of catching up with friends whenever I can. And yeah, traveling a bunch for this, that, and the other. I don't do well when I'm left to my own devices. So I find ways to fill the time for sure.
Yeah, there might, at some point you might want to dig into that a little bit, but you know, I personally cannot talk, Cyrus. So I think we're cut from the same cloth a little bit in that way.
Yes, sir.
All right, let's get into a case from CashLack because we have a lot to talk about. COPD, this is a big topic. Paul Wirtz. Wirtz, we're going to call you for this one because we can't call you Paul W. Paul, we've been down. Paul Williams, we've been down this before.
Yeah, no, there's no point in relitigating this.
All right,
yeah,
so it's... Paul Williams, you're Paul, you will be Paul and Wirtz will be Wirtz for this one. Okay, Wirtz, can you read the case?
That sounds great. Yep. Anna is our 55-year-old woman who presents for evaluation for progressive shortness of breath. She also has a chronic cough that's developed over the past 2 years. She denies any wheezing, chest pain, or hemoptysis. She has never smoked cigarettes. She recalls having frequent respiratory illnesses as a child, but reports no significant pulmonary symptoms in adulthood until recently. She has worked as a hospital custodian for the past 28 years. Physical exam is notable for a prolonged expiratory phase without wheezing. Spirometry, which is performed as part of her dyspnea workup, reveals an FEV1 over FEC ratio of 0.61 post-bronchodilator, which is consistent with a fixed airflow obstruction. So given that this patient has never smoked, I take it that she basically is disqualified from a diagnosis of COPD. Is that a correct statement?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. No,
flawless reasoning.
So, Yeah, we're done. So it's a great lead in. So we're definitely not done. There's definitely some work to be done here. I'll say that in developed nations where there's a lot of exposure to smoking tends to be a major risk factor. When you see someone who has no smoking history, it does at least call into question the diagnosis. And so things that you need to consider in addition to your classical kind of COPD would be, well, from a diagnostic standpoint, cross-sectional imaging and full PFTs. By cross-sectional imaging, what I mean is a CT of the chest. It doesn't have to necessarily be a quote-unquote high resolution, which would be kind of inspiratory, expiratory, prone imaging. And then your full PFTs are going to be your spirometry as you've done, but it's also going to include plethysmography, so kind of the body box. And then it's going to include your DLCO testing. So we're looking for any sort of diffusion limitation when we do that. Why do we do those things? Well, there are things that can look like classic COPD. The first one that comes to mind in someone who's a little on the younger side, and I would say this person is at 55, would be an alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which previously in the GOLD guidelines, they set a certain age kind of like below which you would always want to screen for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. I don't remember what that age is. And the reason is now the quote from GOLD 2025 is all individuals with a diagnosis of COPD should undergo screening for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. And that's regardless of age or ethnicity. And so, it's something that you want to consider. The cross-sectional imaging is helpful because the classic finding there would be bibasilar emphysematous changes. But also that cross-sectional imaging will reveal things like bronchiectasis. And then getting to the full PFTs, in someone who has what we sort of call colloquially burned out asthma or advanced asthma with significant air trapping, that can also kind of throw off your spirometric findings. It can impact your potentially your bronchodilator response, depending on how long that person has had untreated asthma for, longstanding untreated asthma. And then the other thing that I'll mention too, in this particular case with the exposures that you alluded to, is this chronic hypersensitivity pneumonitis or other parenchymal disease. That's not classically going to present as obstruction on your PFTs, but I would say it really shouldn't obviate the need for a broad workup.
Cyrus, can I ask you to speak more about the cross-sectional imaging? I think, are you saying that's for all cases suspected COPD? In this case, where you don't have a clear tobacco exposure, like I guess what I'm asking is sort of where in the timing of the workup is the cross-sectional imaging for most patients? Is it every single patient? Is it ones with persistent symptoms despite treatment? Like how, can you just talk me to when to pull the trigger for that?
That's a great question. So I'm going to cheat a little bit and say, as a pulmonologist, oftentimes patients come to me with imaging. So I have the benefit of reviewing that. Now, to sort of advise the primary care physician on, you know, how to approach this, I think that if you have a patient with a really good story for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, let's say they do have that longstanding smoking history, they've got some of the cardinal symptoms, the progressively increasing cough, dyspnea, especially with exertion, mucopurulent cough, those sorts of things. I don't necessarily feel like the cross-sectional imaging upfront is going to add a whole lot. Now, recognize that we don't want to conflate this with lung cancer screening or that low-dose CT scan that many of these patients are going to also be eligible for. And that's another big reason why I tend to see cross-sectional imaging in these people anyway. So I guess just to kind of be quick about it, I would say if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck, and you probably don't need to necessarily pull the trigger on cross-sectional imaging at that point in time. But if something doesn't fit, if that illness script is violated in some way, shape, or form, then I think your due diligence would include getting cross-sectional imaging.
No, thanks. That makes sense.
And I wanted to just swing back to the full PFT. So spirometry, that's you're getting your like FEV1, FVC, and the ratio. The plethysmography that you mentioned, that would sometimes on the order, that's lung volumes you're talking about there, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the DLCO is just the diffusion capacity. So those are sometimes some places like it defaults to full PFTs. Other places will let you choose just the spiro or the lung volumes or the DLCO. And with the alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, you know, this to me, I didn't realize it was such a strong recommendation now. It kind of reminds me, Paul Williams, of the, you know, the recommendation, like a lot of specialists want us to test all patients with high blood pressure for hyperaldosteronism, and it's not being done. And I would venture to guess that alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency is not being tested for in all patients with COPD, I would guess. Cyrus, if we were to order that, can Dr. Paul Williams and I interpret that? Is it easy to interpret? Is it just like obviously low or deficient or not?
It is. I would say, well, first and foremost, I'm also guilty of not getting it in every patient. I think, again, if I have the imaging already and it's not consistent with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, then I'm not sure that ordering that test is terribly worthwhile. I mean, maybe I'm missing some folks who are really just these cryptic cases that also sound like classic COPD or whatever. But yeah, I don't order it all the time. Maybe I should order it more. But to answer your question, yes, it will come back as low or normal. And then I would say if it comes back as low, a lot of times it's worthwhile to repeat the test, because I've seen it to where it'll come back low, you'll repeat it, and then it's normal, and it's kind of a spurious low. If it's low times two, then I would just send that patient to pulmonary, and then we can sort of tease it out a little bit more.
Dr. Williams?
Yeah, no, I first of all, I appreciate, Cyrus, the Williams approach, just repeating it to a number you like, but then, yeah, right. I feel like it's something I would order. It would come back like one below the upper limit of normal, and then I would just be like, but yes, I'll probably try to be a little bit more diligent about ordering it. But yeah, I do see, I feel like my pulmonology colleagues are pretty good about picking up my slack there, but it's not something I think to order every single time for sure.
I think maybe one of the reasons they're making such a strong recommendation, and Cyrus, I think maybe we learned this from you at some point or one of our guests, is that if they have it, there is a foundation, right, that will help patients access the medication, and it can potentially be very beneficial to connect people with medication. So it's treatable. You're not just like finding a problem that you can't treat, right?
That's correct. And then presumably too, it's like with, you know, folks that have hypercoagulability, you know, you might determine that that patient's family members, children or what have you, are also at risk, screen yeah. earlier, that sort of thing.
Okay. Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. Listen, I've been using Freed and tools like it for over 2 years, and it is game changing. It really does free you from the charting, from that worry of always having notes to close out. So check it out and start your free trial today. No credit card needed. Use code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. Go to getfreed.ai. This episode is brought to you by Grammarly. Audience, Grammarly has been a sponsor for a very long time now, and we use it when we're doing our show notes, when we're doing our emails, when we're making presentations. Grammarly follows you everywhere you work, and it's there to support you, to get the right tone, to make sure that your sentences are clear, that you're getting your message across. Grammarly is one easy place to get quick help from AI whenever you're writing. 90% of professionals say Grammarly has saved them time writing and editing their work, and 93% report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. It's less hassle and more focus no matter what you're writing. Just start a new doc from the Grammarly homepage, and when you open a doc, start typing right away or ask Grammarly's AI chat for help anytime, whether it's to kick off your ideas or polish them. Sign up for free and experience how Grammarly can elevate your professional writing from start to finish. Visit grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. All right. Well, let's move through a little bit. So we talked about a little bit about the baseline testing, but like, what are you doing to size someone up besides you said cross-sectional imaging, you said full PFTs, maybe alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, but how are you like kind of classifying what's going on in a patient with a new diagnosis of COPD?
Yeah. Okay, perfect. So I can't overestimate the importance of a thorough history and physical first and foremost. So we're going to do those things, you know, ask those questions, what have you. We talked about Spiro. I also just want to be clear. I think really any patient that's coming in with a pulmonary complaint, with very few exceptions, should get a AP and lat chest x-ray. So I would get that almost right at the jump. You don't want to miss a giant new mass or something like that. You just really don't want to miss that, or something that's like obstructing the trachea, something causing extrinsic compression. That's really quite low hanging fruit. So let's say now that we've confirmed the diagnosis, now we need to talk about our priorities here. So is this, where does this person kind of fall out when it comes to their new diagnosis COPD? So what we're going to want to do first is like look at the ratio. So make sure that they meet the gold criteria for obstruction, which is an FEV1 over FVC ratio of less than 0.7. And if I may just briefly, because I think it's like, I'm embarrassed by how long it took me to really appreciate this. When you look at that FEV1 and that FVC, the FEV1 is simply how much air that person's able to blow out in the first second. The FVC is how much air are they able to blow out in a 6 second effort. And that's why the respiratory therapist will be yelling, blow, 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 keep going, keep going, keep going. With normal physiology, you should be able to blow out about 80% of your vital capacity in the first second. That's why if you look at those graphs, there's a big kind of inflection point, and then it plateaus for the remaining 5 seconds or so. In obstructive lung disease, that big inflection gets kind of dragged out because they're not able to exhale as forcefully or as effectively. But in most cases, especially early in the disease, that FVC remains relatively unchanged. I'm painting in broad strokes here, but sure. just relatively unchanged. And so that's how you end up with that ratio of the, you know, the numerator is, you know, over the denominator. That's how you end up with that less than 0.7. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in comparison to asthma, where we actually look at the lower limit of normal or you look at Z scores, it's not that fixed 0.7. And there's a lot of debate amongst pulmonologists and the gold group, so on and so forth, of like, okay, why are we still using 0.7? My understanding from kind of reading the literature is it just makes it an easier diagnosis. And kind of like with the new definition of ARDS, the lower the threshold is to make the diagnosis, the easier it is to make the diagnosis, the sooner it gets people thinking about the appropriate treatments. So sorry, I know that's a lot of background, but I do think it's important. So getting to the grading. So we have golds 1 through 4. Gold 1 would be an FEV1 of greater than or equal to 80% of predicted, and that's post-bronchodilator. Gold 2 is 50 to 79, 3 is 30 to 49, and 4 is going to be less than 30. So that's really going to be your grade. You're then going to determine from a symptom and history standpoint whether that patient is A, B, or E kind of class or whatever you want to call it. And this is different from previous guidelines, like in 2022, I think even 2023, where we had A, B, C, and D. Really, what we're looking at with your A and your B are folks that are less symptomatic or more symptomatic, and your E are the folks that exacerbate. So they made it easy to remember, E for exacerbation. In terms of what differentiates an A from a B, that's really going to be lower versus higher MMRC scores or CAT scores. The MMRC, also known as the Modified Medical Research Council Dyspnea Scale, essentially scores dyspnea from 0 to 4, 0 being only with strenuous exercise, 4 being too dyspneic to leave the house, essentially. And as you can imagine, folks that are in the higher category are going to be more towards the B, and lower category are going to be towards the A.
Paul really enjoyed how simple that acronym is, right, Paul?
I'm just picturing a group of pulmonologists just sitting around being like, well, okay, it's going to be A, B, or E, and that's basically MMRC on a score of 0 to 4, and then just high-fiving it, just how easy it is for everybody. It's like, we did it, man. We really... Now those dumb primary care doctors will be able to crack this case wide open.
So it's funny you should say that about the MMRC. We also have the CAT, and the CAT is an easier acronym. It's the COPD assessment tool, but it's more complicated to actually calculate. And that's looking at basically cough, phlegm, chest tightness, breathlessness, activity tolerance, or confidence. And then it's also looking at like sleep, energy level, those kind of factors. So depending on which tool you use, again, higher scores are going to push you more towards B, lower scores are going to push you towards A. But then if a patient has a hospitalization for COPD in the last year, or if they have had like kind of 2 moderate exacerbations, you know, they've been needed to be on oral corticosteroids, let's say, antibiotics, that sort of thing, that would push them immediately to E, and their symptoms are almost irrelevant. And the reason for that is folks that are recurrent exacerbators are at higher risk for more aggressive disease, disease that's more likely to progress. And then kind of finally, that does factor into phenotypes to a certain degree. And I don't want to get too much into this because it gets a little complicated, but the frequent exacerbator is one sort of phenotype of COPD, but there are many others. There are folks that have pulmonary hypertension, or folks that might have that asthma COPD overlap, folks that maybe have chronic respiratory failure or multiple comorbidities, things like obesity, for example, or other like sleep disordered breathing. So there's a whole bunch of phenotypes, and that's also going to factor into how you manage the patient and some considerations for how you want to provide kind of good holistic care.
Cyrus, it almost seems to me like the old gold 1, 2, 3, 4 with your FEV1 cutoffs, it seems like those are no longer that relevant for your treatment decisions. And it's really more the A, B, or E score, and then whether or not they have a high number of eosinophils or not that really determine your treatment. Is that true? Is kind of like we're going more on the clinical symptoms that someone's having than the straight up number from spirometry?
I think so. I think that as our understanding of COPD evolves, we're looking at it as more of a syndromic condition rather than being very draconian about like you know, what does the spirometry show us, and how are we going to treat the COPD? As we're going to talk about, I think, later, many folks with COPD have these complicated phenotypes, which can include other comorbid conditions. And so it's incumbent on us as good primary care physicians to, you know, look at the patient holistically and not just focus on their lungs. And I'm saying this as a pulmonologist. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to ask, like, because I remember, and Paul Williams, do you remember, like, the FEV1 was, like, such a talk of things? Like, we trained at a place where there was a lot of talk about that. But, I mean, it seems to me now, like, it's not even a number I really ever think about much. I don't know about you, Paul Williams. What do you think?
I mean, I use it to show off to pulmonologists that just to know, like, so they know who they're messing with. But, like, I agree with you. From a clinical standpoint, it doesn't really affect all that much what I do.
Yeah. And is that, Cyrus, is that because you could have like a Gold's 3 or 4 by FEV1 and not exacerbate, or but you could be like a Gold's 2 and have like frequent exacerbations? So that's why we just sort of go by the exacerbations for how aggressive we are with treatment rather than just the FEV1 alone.
So it's an interesting point. So I think that there's a lot of value in the FEV1 because it does give you an idea as to like where that patient is with respect to their kind of disease progression.
Yeah.
And the lower the FEV1 is, the less runway that patient really has, both in terms of like their day-to-day, but also from my standpoint as an intensivist, like that patient gets admitted to the hospital and their baseline lung function is really like severely impaired. That's going to impact the decisions that I make, perhaps if they end up on the ventilator or things of that nature. But to get to y'all's point, I think that the evolution in kind of COPD assessment is starting to focus more on those patient-centered variables, the MMRC, the CAT, and of course their exacerbation frequency, because even more than FEV1, that does seem to be a greater prognostic indicator. And so I know it's a little bit of a cop out, but I think that's probably what I would say. The last point I'll make here is that we do consider that element of obstruction when we calculate a BODE index, which is something you can do as a primary care physician as well. It's a great tool for estimating 4-year mortality, and it looks at BMI, obstruction, dyspnea, according to that MMRC that Paul loves so much, and then the 6-minute walk test. So I think there's a bit of a paradigm shift, but it's almost like the aperture has been opened rather than it's just kind of narrow and totally turning, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So FEV1 is still just a useful marker of like underlying disease severity or just like damage to the lung. Maybe the way we would think, you know, we can know someone's EF. You can know someone that has an EF of 20% and they're totally compensated and they're doing okay, but they're still, you know, their heart is still very sick.
Yes. That's a really great analogy. I like that.
All right. Wirtz, you want to get to the next part of the case?
Yes. Real quick, is there any way at all that you can arrive on a diagnosis of COPD with a FEV1 over FVC that's greater than 0.7?
Yeah, great question. So according to Gold, you really need to have that FEV1 over FVC that is greater than 0.7. That's the operational diagnostic threshold for COPD worldwide. And it's not really dependent on labs reference equations. It's just, you know, that's... It is what it is. Now, what I will say is in 2025, Gold does ask us to be a little bit smarter around the margins and consider things like the lower limit of normal and Z scores. And also, we're encouraged to use race neutral reference equations, which I think is huge. We used to actually have race specific reference equations. And we've found that doesn't really help patients out. It actually can disadvantage certain groups. So Gold 2025 ATS, they support, what's called the race neutral GLI. If we're going to be using those, lower limits of normal and the Z scores. So as I was kind of alluding to earlier, that 0.7, fixed criterion is really chosen for simplicity and consistency. But there is a long running debate as to whether we should be adjusting it or not. I think that there's also the question of like, what do you do with a pre-COPD patient or a PRISM patient, which is what we call preserved ratio impaired spirometry? That gets a little bit into the weeds, but...
Yeah, Cyrus, I can't deal with another. We already have pre-diabetes, pre-hypertension.
Yeah,
I can't deal with another pre...
I'm sorry. Yeah. We're trying to catch stuff early. I don't know what to tell you, but I guess what if I had to be brief to answer your question, I would say, according to Gold, the ratio is 0.70. However, in folks that are flirting with that ratio or like, you know, very close to it and do meet criteria from a lower limit of normal or Z-score standpoint based upon the GLI equations, I would look at that patient very carefully. I would really do a good symptom inventory. I would keep close tabs on them. And, you know, that might be someone, and this is my expert opinion, I might consider trialing on a bronchodilator of some sort and seeing if that results in an improvement in their quality of life.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that leads into our next question here and the next part of the case pretty well. So for this patient, for Anna, her post-bronchodilator FEV1 over FVC ratio came back at 0.61, which by Gold criteria confirms obstruction. Should we think of that cutoff value as a universal standard, or is it dependent on the lab's reference equations? And more importantly, how is Gold 2025 encouraging us to rethink these reference values, particularly with their focus on health equity? And what does this mean for how we interpret results like Anna's in day-to-day primary care practice?
Yeah, it's almost like I had a crystal ball. So I'll say that, just to kind of summarize or reiterate, yes, definitely does meet the criteria. I think, you know, it helps have that universal standard, and I would maintain that universal standard. The Gold group is a bunch of very, very smart folks across the world that get together and kind of like reaffirm or update our approach to COPD. And so I think that I agree with their logic. I think it's sound, to make it kind of easy. Recognize that COPD is an incredibly prevalent disease. Upwards of, you know, depending on where you look, I think in Colombia, if memory serves, I think that was in Colombia or Venezuela, it's like 20% of the population has COPD. It's like some absurd number. And there's also a huge delta in many places between who has the disease and who knows they have the disease, who's been diagnosed with it. So I like 0.7, Gold likes 0.7, the ABIM likes 0.7. So that's what I would remember. And then, like I said, when you get to the margins, I think it's okay to kind of fudge a little bit, and Gold does encourage this. You know, be smart, use those other tools that you have, and also just make sure that we're using those race neutral GLI equations so that we're not disenfranchising groups and kind of limiting their access to good COPD care.
And Cyrus, the lower limit of normal and the Z-scores, those are not something that I was taught to look for on the PFTs, but are they just right there next? Like
they're right there.
They're right there. Okay.
Yes, sir.
I will
yes,
now. Now I will see them next time I look at the PFTs. I don't know, Paul, do you look at those, Williams?
Yeah, I was talking to Paul and I was just like, oh, it's all Z-scores now. And I was like, oh, God, I don't even know what that means. So I had to like go through and actually sort of relook this stuff up. So I'm paying a little bit more attention now than I was before.
All right. Yeah, I'm going to have to pay attention to that. Okay, Wirtz, let's get to our next case because we got a bunch more stuff to go through.
Absolutely. So we got Enzo now. He is our 70-year-old male presenting to his primary care provider for an annual visit. He has a history of CKD, CAD, hypertension, hyperlipidemia. He has a 25-pack-year smoking history. He quit about 5 years ago. You obtain routine lung cancer screening with low-dose CT, which shows no evidence of malignancy, but does demonstrate some emphysematous changes. So given we know that this COPD encompasses both the chronic bronchitis and the emphysema phenotypes, now that we have imaging that says, you know, emphysematous changes, does that give us the diagnosis of COPD according to Gold 2025? And then how can we use these annual low-dose CTs as kind of a screening tool or a tool that shows COPD may be on the radar?
That's a really great question because this comes up a lot. I get a lot of referrals for folks that have emphysema on their CT scan, and they're asking me to kind of treat the patient for COPD. And that's not really kind of the way it works, I guess. So as I sort of mentioned earlier, that annual low-dose CT scan, or really the low-dose CT scan in and of itself, is really meant for patients that are deemed high risk for developing lung cancer. So in the United States, that means, at least today, it means folks that are between 50 and 80 years old who have a smoking history of greater than or equal to 20 pack years. Those that are current smokers or have quit within the last 15 years, those folks are still going to be screened. And then you can stop screening if the patient has quit 15 or more years ago, or if they develop a health problem that's going to in and of itself kind of truncate that patient's life expectancy, or the patient's like like completely unwilling and uninterested in any sort of therapy whatsoever if they were to have lung cancer, kind of like ignorance is bliss. So really that LDCT or low-dose CT is not a screening tool for COPD. Now, what I'll say is if you, like me, get a referral for someone who had a CT scan that shows emphysematous changes, which I think is a totally valid and great referral because I get it. It's like, what do I do with this? What I would do is then take a nice kind of repeat history and physical. I would get those pulmonary function tests, additional testing if indicated, and kind of progress as such. Just recognize that really in GOLD, COPD is defined as this heterogeneous lung condition marked by that, those chronic respiratory symptoms, dyspnea, cough, sputum production, exacerbations related to kind of alveolar or airway inflammation. Nowhere there does it say that, and oh, by the way, they need to have CT findings.
So this guy we gave you here, he's 70. He has some chronic medical conditions. He smoked for 25 pack years, but he's quit for 5 years. So he would meet criteria for screening, but we're not really giving you anything except that he has imaging findings that could be consistent with COPD. We're not giving you the clinical symptoms. Let's give you the rest of this. So he tells us he actually does have a cough and he does have shortness of breath. And his CAT and MMRC, we do those, and the scores are 5 and 1 respectively. So what are we going to do for him as far as starting medications, and how might that conversation go for you?
That's awesome. So we're going to assume then that this patient does meet spirometric criteria for COPD, and then they've got the CAT, they've got the MMRC. So at this point, I think it's very reasonable to talk about bronchodilators. Now, I'm not sure if we're going to get to this or not, but I think this is as good a place as any. First and foremost, we need to remember our sort of non-pharmacologic or like pharmacologic adjacent therapies, I guess. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, is the latter, I mean your vaccinations. So things like pneumonia, RSV, COVID, you know, those are vaccinations that you want to make sure these patients have. And I say adjacent because like they're obviously not getting that on the reg. I hope they're not getting like an RSV every day. But then things like smoking cessation. That's like, you know, items number 1, 2, and 3, if that patient is still smoking, we have to make sure that we stop smoking. And whether that means you use, cognitive behavioral therapy, nicotine supplementation, or medications like bupropion, varenicline. There's a new kid on the block that's related to varenicline that's got some very promising data behind it. Great. And then things like pulmonary rehabilitation and oxygen therapy, if indicated based upon their resting oxygenation or their walk test. I don't think I need to go into all the details of all of that. It's kind of readily Googleable, I will say. But I did want to say that stuff up front, you really should consider it in the same breath, no pun intended, as your inhaler therapies. The reason I say that is that by and large, the data supporting the mortality benefits in COPD from everything I just told you about outweighs inhaler therapy. So we think of COPD as this disease that we treat with inhalers. And we do. We treat the symptoms. And don't get me wrong, St. George respiratory questionnaires and other sort of like patient tests, quality of life, what have you, super important. But the things I mentioned up front, those are the things that are going to add ideally quality adjusted life years to that patient. Now, assuming you've done that, we can talk about inhalers. I know that was a lot. Before I get into that, do you guys have any questions on that first stuff?
I really actually like that point. You're speaking to us in primary care with that because it is true. I mean, the inhalers are expensive. And
yes,
when you look at like they're trying to prevent exacerbations, but I like things that actually prevent mortality in COPD, the smoking cessation, if someone has severe like resting hypoxemia, the long-term oxygen therapy, right? And then vaccinations can save lives as well. So I think that's great. And
they do.
If the elusive pulmonary rehab, Paul Williams, have you ever had a patient successfully get pulmonary rehab?
Yeah, a couple. I mean, they're unicorns, but yeah, it happens from time to time.
Yeah. 15 years sometimes, in primary care, and he's like, yeah,
sometimes you can like, sometimes you can backdoor them into like cardiac rehab. Sometimes that's a little easier. I don't know.
If we count board exams, Paul, I've saved countless lives with pulmonary rehab.
All the lives.
Statistically, about 80% of lives I've saved with board exams.
Full disclosure, what I'm about to say is a sponsored promotion for locumstory.com. But the weird thing here is there's nothing they're trying to sell you. Locumstory.com is simply a free, unbiased, educational resource about locum tenens. It's not an agency. They simply exist to answer your questions about the how-tos of locums on their website, podcast, webinars, videos, and they even have a Locums 101 crash course. Locumstory.com is where you should go to find out if locum tenens make sense for you and your career goals. What makes locumstory.com unique is that it's more of a peer-to-peer platform with real physicians sharing their experiences and their stories, both the good and the bad about working locum tenens, hence the name Locum Story. Locumstory.com is a self-service tool, which means you can poke through their content at your own pace with no pressure or obligation. So that's it for this sponsored promotion, which was sponsored by a completely free-to-use sponsor, locumstory.com. But Cyrus, what about exercise?
Yeah. So, I mean, I love that question. Assuming that the patient has no other functional limitations or contraindications to certain exercises, I am a huge fan of exercise in COPD. What we need to recognize, too, is one of the big issues with COPD, and we talked about this eons ago when we discussed sarcopenia, is cachexia and sarcopenia. And so, yes, the cardio is important and all that stuff, but the muscle loss that you see in these folks, especially as their disease progresses and they're kind of breathing harder and they're more metabolically active, is no joke. And so I would say if the patient's game to get in the gym or whatever and start exercising, then you should fuel that fire all day long and on Sundays. If they are hesitant, that is a great opportunity to utilize pulmonary rehab to prove to them that there is a way forward and that you don't have to be so worried. And what I'll say, and this may sound a little sacrilegious, and I'm sorry to the, you know, cloaked pulmonary, brethren out there in the background. If in your, so my opinion on this is if in your clinical judgment, you talk to a patient and you think that they're going to be great to kind of start an exercise routine on their own and, you know, you can give them some guidance, which there's plenty of resources out there that you can utilize. They don't necessarily need to go to pulmonary rehab. They need to be moving. They need to be exercising. That's what I care about. Whatever's going to be the lowest barrier to entry to that effect is gravy.
And is it, I don't know, are there interventions like looking at pulmonary cachexia, you know, they're in a catabolic state, like looking at sort of like caloric intake or protein intake to see if that benefits people? I imagine they're just not hungry or they're too out of breath to be eating like enough calories and that's part of the issue. But is that, have any of those interventions been beneficial?
So I know, I cannot remember the study off the top of my head. I know I have seen that data and what I have found to be effective, because you're right, a lot of these folks don't have huge appetites or whatever their other issues is, those, you know, protein shakes, the whatever, you know, protein shake or you know, meal supplement your patient can get access to that they can afford. Because I know they're also not cheap necessarily, but some of them I think you can even get in like discounts on, or there may even be insurance benefits. I'm not totally certain on that. But that's a great way to help support your patient who's just not able to kind of eat via, you know, meat and potatoes, what they need to get.
Okay.
Yeah, you probably, I can't imagine you know the answer to this, or maybe the study's not even been done yet, but as we're thinking this through, I'm wondering about, now that GLP-1 agonists are just so wildly popular and everyone sort of demands them or is inadvertently on them, like what the impact on COPD would be if there is a class effect or not, just with the potential for muscle loss and the weight loss that comes along with it and the decreased appetite. Like I wonder how that might impact COPD as a specific disease state. I'm sure someone's looked, but it has not occurred to me before now.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great, I should look into that myself. I'm sure it has been looked into and it will get looked into. I think the only, a lot of COPD patients do have concomitant OSA. So not everyone is going to have that COPD cachexia, right? And so we know that from the SURMOUNT trial, tirzepatide was proven to be an effective treatment for OSA. And so if you have a patient with COPD and OSA and you put them on tirzepatide, for that, you do wonder. I think that the muscle loss is definitely, there's definitely high potential there. So I would just caution the prescribing clinician to think that through. And if you were to go that route, which I mean, there are cardiovascular benefits, or of course the endocrine benefits and so on and so forth to a lot of the GLP-1 agents or GLP-1/GIP agents, depending if it's tirzepatide. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's a total no-go, but I think I'd have to have a patient that tolerates the medication really well. They have just like horrible gastroparesis that they can't work through, then it's not going to work. And it just becomes even more important that they're getting nutritional supplements or whatever to make sure that they're losing the right kind of weight and not becoming progressively sarcopenic.
So let's go on to just talk about what inhalers we have as choice for first line. I know it's a bit different than asthma, where long-acting beta agonists are never a monotherapy for asthma, right? But what about for COPD? What are our first-line options?
Yes, 15 minutes later, we can get back to your original question. So sorry, but like I said, that was like
no,
important stuff.
No, we took the diversion I liked it. I wanted to talk about that stuff. So thank you for the diversion.
Good. So yeah, the inhalers, of course, pretty much everyone with a diagnosis of COPD is going to end up on an inhaler. So I would say if the patient's minimally symptomatic, then you're okay using a short-acting agent or like an as-needed agent may be okay. So something like a SABA short-acting beta agonist, an albuterol. Now, I understand that oftentimes these folks have minimal bronchodilator response on their PFTs. I get it. But there are a couple other elements here to consider. One is that some folks will swear to you that they get a benefit from their albuterol, even if you don't see it on the spirometry. And frankly, again, my opinion here, who am I to say that they're not getting a benefit? So long as they're using it within reason and they're feeling better and it's helping to facilitate their exercise and so on and so forth, I'm good with it. The other thing to recognize, and we don't typically look at this as part of our spirometric assessment. It's not recommended actually per the ATS kind of PFT guidelines. But the FEF 25 to 75, which looks at kind of the medium to small sized airways, a lot of folks will have a bronchodilator response there, but they won't have a traditional bronchodilator response with respect to just the FEV1 itself. And so there could be that physiologic benefit that is captured via that one element of testing, but is not reflected in the classical interpretation of spirometry. So with all that being said, there is a subset of folks that I think you could maybe get away with SABA. Now, that all being said, generally speaking, we're going to be using either a LABA or a LAMA, or oftentimes a LABA-LAMA combination. And so ATS actually favors starting folks on a LABA-LAMA combination. And the classic thing there might be tiotropium olodaterol. The brand name for that is Stiolto. Of course, don't endorse that, but that is the common one that is used. But your LABA-LAMA combo is often used up front, even though the guidelines say, hey, you could try just a LABA or a LAMA.
We're saying LABA-LAMA a lot. So LABA, long-acting beta agonist, that's vilanterol, formoterol, salmeterol. You said olodaterol.
Yes.
And then your LAMAs, that's tiotropium, umeclidinium.
Yes.
Are there any others?
Glycopyrrolate.
Glycopyrrolate. Okay. So we have a couple of each in the various combinations that are available to people.
We do.
Okay.
We do. And what I was going to, so thank you for kind of underlining that, because sometimes I just roll through it. It's like just part of my lexicon. But the other kind of point I want to make here is that, because when I read this, I actually did a double take. Notice that I mentioned LABA monotherapy, so that long-acting beta agonist. So in asthma, that is really not recommended. There were some studies back in the day that showed a signal for harm, especially in patients that have cardiovascular comorbidities. Some of that has been called into question recently. And in the COPD population, that signal was not present. And so that's right. Why you could conceivably get away with that. Now, most folks that I come across will either be on tiotropium monotherapy, or they might be on, tiotropium with a long-acting beta agonist as well. That's a common thing that you'll see. I can't honestly say that I've seen someone in my clinic on just salmeterol or something.
Can I ask Paul Williams? Paul, are you seeing most people on a long-acting beta agonist and inhaled corticosteroid just because those are the only things that are affordable for a lot of people?
I wouldn't say a lot. I feel like I'm still seeing some leftovers just because there was a lot of I think brand name recognition for one particular brand of that. So I will see people that are kind of grandfathered down on a medication that has the long-acting inhaled corticosteroid just because that was around and had, I think, good marketing, which is not a great reason. But so, yeah, that's it. But by and large, I feel like I've never, I shouldn't say never, but I cannot recall the last time I ever saw someone on a long-acting beta agonist monotherapy. Like, I know that that's an option, but I feel like I've rarely seen that. It's usually the llamas that I see folks on if they're on something that feels like appropriate initial therapy.
Yep, absolutely. And to that point, Matt, you know, we'll probably touch on this again, but just that inhaled corticosteroids, cornerstone in asthma therapy.
Yep.
Indicated in COPD in a certain subset of patients.
Right.
Really, you should not lead off with an inhaled corticosteroid in your COPD patient that has no allergic signal whatsoever and has like no exacerbation history.
Mm-hmm. And this is besides the allergic signal, which I guess you could get by clinical history, the eosinophils greater than 300, greater than or equal to 300 is what's listed in the guidelines. That seems like a number where like month to month, if you check labs on people, you know, they might have eosinophils 1 month and not the next month. And
it's
so
true.
I feel like that seems like a pretty labile like marker to be guiding a big treatment decision on with in steroids, increased risk for pneumonia, right? The inhaled steroids.
It's true. And it gets even more complicated when you recognize that like there's a potential benefit in the 100 to 300 category.
Too. Yeah.
So it like opens the aperture and it increases the effect of like, you know, how you might just by chance get a number that fits.
Yeah.
So
I'm also just now seeing like if someone can get it approved, a lot of people are just being put on the triple therapy with the LAMA, LABA, ICS, inhaled corticosteroid is ICS. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And that's a great point too. So, you know, I think depending on the patient presentation, you know, if the patient's like really not meeting criteria for being on an ICS, this is kind of the idea of like a bias to action where it's like, okay, well, if one inhaler is good, then, or if one inhaled medication is good, then two is going to be better and three is going to be just the best. Bee's knees. Well, like you said, there are risk factors to using ICS in an inappropriate patient. And so, you know, I get it for sure that like a lot of folks put them on that medication either because they're limited in terms of the formulary or maybe they think they're doing right by the patient. And certainly I don't want to cast shade on those individuals, but from an education standpoint, we should be a little more deliberate when it comes to those inhaled corticosteroids because of the risk profile.
Yeah. So who are you putting on the triple therapy? Because I know there was a study that maybe there was a mortality benefit seen with this. And I remember people making a big deal out of it because it was most of the time with inhalers, the only endpoint they've been able to prove is less exacerbations, right? But not mortality.
Yeah.
And with this, one of these triple therapies, I think they maybe got it over the line with a mortality endpoint. But like, who are you selecting for triple therapy?
Sure. So to kind of foot stomp this point, by triple therapy, what we're really meaning is we're going to add ICS. So, mm-hmm. So double therapy should never be like LAMA ICS or LABA ICS, mm-hmm. right? So basically it's who are we adding inhaled corticosteroid for? So if we want to be, again, very precise about this, folks that have a eosinophil count greater than 300 definitely, you know, should be thinking about it. If the patient has not been adequately controlled, if they're still symptomatic despite dual therapy,
mm-hmm.
And certainly if those folks have had exacerbations. In folks that are in that 100 to 300 category, could be an option. Again, I'd want to look at their exacerbation profile. Maybe I'll do some allergy testing. Maybe I'll look at an IgE level. I mean, there are other kind of, this is me coloring outside the lines, so I do want to make that clear. But I'll try to look for a reason why it might be a benefit. And then the idea of the eosinophils in gold, it really is a continuum. It's not an absolute cutoff. And I would say the other caveat is folks that have had frequent exacerbations despite being on dual therapy, even with a eosinophil count that's less than 100, there may be a role there for ICS, even when you consider the potential increase in pneumonia risk, because these are folks that are recurrently exacerbating already.
Mm-hmm.
So the juice may be worth the squeeze in these patients. they're just going to need to be followed closely. And it really should be a clinical decision that is made deliberately and not just like a knee-jerk step up. Recognize too that the other therapies that we have outside of ICS to kind of add to COPD management, they're not without side effects either. And generally speaking, an inhaled corticosteroid in someone who's been taught appropriate technique, who's swishing and spitting after use, brushing their teeth, what have you, you know, if it means that I'm saving them exacerbations, if it means especially that I'm saving them exposure to oral glucocorticoids, then I think it's worth a shot. And this is, again, some of this is recognized by the GOLD guidelines. Some of this is me just from my perspective. Mm-hmm. But by the book, greater than 300 on those EOs, between 100 and 300 on those EOs is like a question mark. And then they say probably little to no benefit if less than 100.
Let's go to Paul Williams. Paul, did you notice they talked about comorbidities and then in this one? I guess that was new for the GOLD guidelines.
Yeah, I did. And of course, I love it because it's just sort of, I think we were talking a little before recording, like this, there's a lot of stuff that we can do that will positively impact the patient's COPD and their symptoms and their comorbidities that we can sort of address proactively, which I really appreciate them sort of bringing up, mentioning. It's the things like being mindful of osteoporosis, since these patients are often on recurrent courses of steroids, great thought, or the fact that people with COPD often have higher prevalence of depression, anxiety. So we're supposed to be screening these folks anyway, but it's a nice little sort of nudge to do so. So I appreciated the shout out to primary care and the things that we can do to sort of address the other sort of more holistic elements of COPD care.
Yeah. Cyrus, any other ones you wanted to point out just for us in primary care to really like think about as comorbidities? You already mentioned the vaccinations and, yes. You know, I think that's good medicine, but what else? Anything else?
Yeah. I mean, I think, so when I see these folks, and this is why it can sometimes be helpful to have a pulmonologist on board, is like, for me, when I see advanced COPD, one of the first things I think about, really one of the first things everyone should think about, especially like I said, in those advanced cases, is cardiovascular disease. So, and that kind of manifests in two forms. So we know that if the patient has a history of smoking that's led to their COPD, the likelihood that they may have some coronary artery disease also related to that smoking exposure, among other things, is appreciable. And so we should be kind of screening with appropriate questions and testing for that. But then also the other element here is, does that patient have pulmonary hypertension? And that's something that you can identify with your echocardiogram, and primary care can order that. You know, you can get that echocardiogram. And so if you see a lot of times the cardiologist will comment on estimated right-sided filling pressures, estimated pulmonary, pulmonary artery pressure. They might comment on right-sided disease, right ventricular dilation, right atrial dilation. If you see those when you get an echo on your COPD patient, I would absolutely send that patient to pulmonary. Even if their symptoms are reasonably well controlled, they should be seen by pulmonary. Mm-hmm. Because that's a significant comorbid condition that needs to be potentially managed in concert with their COPD. But then other things, obviously lung cancer, talked about that, I think a decent amount. And then I think the other thing I would mention, maybe other two things would be, on the flip side, so not the cachexia, but diabetes and metabolic syndrome. We certainly see that with COPD. We want to make sure that those folks are getting appropriate glucose control, especially if they have to be exposed to systemic steroids, which we really hate to do. And then the other one I'll mention is bronchiectasis. So this isn't an episode on bronchiectasis. We could totally talk about that down the road. But the difference with bronchiectasis is you're really going to start to incorporate appropriate airway clearance therapies. And those are therapies that are not at all part of the COPD armamentarium in general. If you identify that on cross-sectional imaging, or if the patient's history is worrisome for that, with maybe some like intermittent scant hemoptysis and really purulent mucus and that deep kind of heavy cough, those are things that would kind of raise my suspicions and make me think.
Okay. So let's progress on Paul Wirtz.
Kelos, can I make one other point briefly? Because I do want to talk about the actual practical approach to triple inhaler therapy just before we move on.
Sure.
Very briefly. So if you are fortunate enough to have a patient who's well insured, for whom you could do your fluticasone, umeclidium, valantrol, or budesonide glycopyrrolate formoterol, those are the two common combinations, then that's great. The first one I mentioned is great because the formulation we have, the brand name for that is Trelegy. That one is a once daily puff, which is nice for patients. I think it's a very patient-centered intervention. But some people don't derive as much of a benefit from that, especially if their inspiratory force is limited, because you have to be able to, it's a powder inhaler, so you have to really be able to get that back into your lungs. So if that doesn't work and you still have pretty good insurance, then you could consider that budesonide glycopyrrolate formoterol. The brand name for that is Breztri, and that's your pressurized MDI. So that's a more maybe familiar mechanism. That one might work a little better in folks that have a limited inspiratory capacity. The last point I want to make here is those are expensive medications. So like they can both be $500 to $600 a month. So if we're trying to be as cost conscious as possible, then you could do generic budesonide formoterol combination plus generic tiotropium. And that might cost kind of $150 to $200 a month. We call that open triple therapy. So I, sorry to kind of turn back to that, but I think that's important for our listeners.
Paul Williams, that's easy, right?
It's not the effort. It's the fact that we're making homemade triple therapy because of insurance issues that just makes me want to. I don't know.
I get it.
All right.
I'm not going to finish the sentence, but yeah, it's God bless.
Okay. So now
we can
words.
Do it, but should we have to?
I guess we can progress on a little bit because we did talk about the triple therapy here. So,
all right. So we're going to paint the picture of maybe a progression. So we got 3 years later. Enzo has progressed clinically. He's been hospitalized twice in the past 2 years for COPD exacerbations, most recently with severe hypercapnia. His VBG on admission showed a CO2 of 77. He improved to 63 by discharge, and this appeared to be his baseline. His bicarb, which was elevated to 39 on admission, came down and stabilized around 34. He's already on triple therapy with budesonide, glycopyrrolate, and formoterol, which they use inconsistently. Eosinophils are currently 100. So for a patient like this, how does Gold 2025 guide us in thinking about next steps? Specifically, can you talk about how we should approach management after repeated exacerbations despite maximal inhaler therapy, and when to consider things like roflumilast, chronic macrolides, pulmonary rehab, and then even home non-invasive ventilation? And with the non-invasive ventilation, how do you counsel patients specifically? Like, do they wear it all day? Is it just at night?
Right.
So patient counseling for that.
Tough case. Yeah. And this is like, this plays out all the time in, you know, hospitals and wards, ICUs. It's challenging when COPD kind of advances. So glad we're going to spend a little time talking about it. So there are a couple concerning things here. The elevation in the serum bicarbonate does suggest that this is sort of like an acute on chronic hypercapnia. Which would be consistent with a sleep-disordered breathing or maybe some nocturnal hypoventilation at the very least. And then the other thing that's worrisome is the uses inconsistently part. Because, you know, I need to understand why we're using it inconsistently and how I can get him to be more consistent with that therapy. What are the barriers to therapy? In large part, because if we're having issues with that, then getting a patient to consistently use non-invasive is going to be a challenge because that is often hard to do. It's uncomfortable. The interfaces can often be challenging. I'll say, like, from that standpoint, because I think this is also worthwhile, like, putting in the time and effort to get that patient with a sleep tech who knows the mask interfaces and can get them set up with something that they like and have them come back and forth and like really dial them in. It's worth its weight in gold. Because if that non-invasive just sits next to them and they never use it, obviously you're not helping them out. So kind of to take a step back and say, you know, how would we approach this patient? As I was sort of alluding to, I want to know why they're inconsistent. I want to kind of confirm some of the foundational stuff. You know, are they, if they're not adherent, why are they not adherent? If they are adherent, are they using good technique? And then I'm going to screen for those confounders or those comorbidities. So have there been big changes to their life? Did they move recently? Did they lose a loved one? Are they depressed? You know, I start folks on SSRIs in my pulmonary clinic, not infrequently, after I kind of talk to them. Like, this is one thing that really bugs me a lot about folks in pulmonary and other subspecialties is we kind of like lose touch with being just a good doctor and a good kind of like patient-centered doctor. And if their depression is getting in the way of them living their life and them adhering to therapy, then I feel like I'm not doing my job to not address that. Otherwise, I think we maybe take a little bit of a tour through some of the therapies that are available. So, you know, when it comes to non-invasive therapy, specifically for that one, if you look at the GOLD 2025 guidelines, which are pretty well aligned with ERS, which is the European Society, ATS, and the Canadian guidelines, we're going to consider that a patient who's got chronic hypercapnia as defined by a PaCO2 of greater than 52 millimeters of mercury. And we do want to measure that after hospital discharge if they've come in for an acute exacerbation. Now, if they are diagnosed with hypercapnia in hospital, I've seen a lot of situations where you are able to get them to go home with non-invasive and then you kind of reassess them later. It kind of just depends on the system that you're working in. And there is some evidence for this. So like HOT HMV was a trial that suggested adding home non-invasive plus long-term oxygen therapy reduced readmissions and improved survival in selected hypercapnic patients. So as far as how you counsel, it's got to be used 6 to 8 hours a night. If the patient has daytime hypercapnia, let's say it's like a combination of COPD and maybe they also have obesity hypoventilation syndrome, that's tough because really the treatment for that is weight loss. And if that's not going to work, a tracheostomy and like chronic oxygen or chronic non-invasive. So outside of that, really, we're talking about nighttime, 6 to 8 hours. There are lots of options too. I don't want to get all into all of this, but you'll hear terms like BiPAP, which is really a trade name for bi-level. You'll also hear about this AVAPS. I wouldn't worry about that. You can let us take care of that, but there's a lot of different options. And what I try to tell patients is like, look, it's going to be tough. It's going to be weird. And it's probably going to suck initially. But the reality is there is great potential for fewer hospitalizations, higher energy levels during the day. And I try to use that as the kind of currency upon which I trade and make sure that these folks have good support, both with sleep and with me, and good kind of close follow-up.
I was just going to say about the non-invasive ventilation. And Paul Williams, I don't remember if you were at this. This was at, I think, SIGHM, the conference a couple years ago. They had a bunch of respiratory therapists there, and they gave the suggestion to just have people for an hour or two before bedtime just wear the CPAP or the BiPAP while they're like awake watching TV, just kind of get used to it. And telling patients, you're probably going to hate it at first, but you'll get used to it. And once you do, you'll love it. And I've had a lot more success once I started doing that. Dr. Williams, any pearls there as America's PCP for how you counsel people?
No more than that. Like, I think that's a great tip and the counseling that it's, people do get used to it. And I have many patients who, you know, start out saying they can't sleep with it and then progress, they can't sleep without it just for being patient and sort of, and working with us. Like, I think just that anticipatory guidance probably goes a long way.
Yeah.
And the consistency too, Paul. I mean, like, you know, the anticipatory guidance is huge, but also just making sure that you're there for that patient and that they have someone to reach out to if they're, well, sucks to suck, I guess. But, okay. So we talked about non-invasive, but I do want to step back to just some of the other therapies, and I'll try to go through these kind of quickly because a lot of these, you know, kind of to not bury the lead, if we're talking about a lot of these therapies, the patient should probably be seen by a pulmonologist.
Yeah.
And so what are those therapies? So classically, it's things like roflumilast or chronic macrolide therapy. So with roflumilast, we're looking at patients that have severe COPD with that chronic bronchitis phenotype. These are folks that maybe have thick mucus-impacted airways, lots of mucopurulent cough, folks that have an FEV1 that's less than 50% and have a lot of exacerbations. The hope is that we're going to reduce exacerbations, but the side effects include weight loss, which not great in COPD, diarrhea, not great, and mood changes, also not great. So I'll be honest with you, I don't use a lot of roflumilast because I find that the side effects kind of suck. And now I have a new agent, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit, that I've had really good success with. But moving on, chronic macrolide therapy. So that's usually going to be azithromycin, classically 250 milligrams a day or 500 milligrams three times a week. Similar idea there is your frequent exacerbators. And evidence comes from a couple trials. There was the macro is one of them, for example, showing reduced exacerbations. Risk there are going to be hearing loss, QT prolongation. So these folks need you know, an audiology assessment. They need EKGs. And I would say in like in Enzo's case, if memory serves, he's a former but not active smoker. So macrolides are on the table. We don't really use them in folks that are active smokers. We already talked about pulmonary rehab, so I'm not going to belabor that point. But what I will say is in GOLD, it's stressed as a core therapy, not an extra. It's not the gilding of the lily. It's a core therapy. Mm-hmm. So I think for some of the classic add-ons, those are the two medical therapies I'll mention. And then, we can talk about some of the other options that are both kind of here and now and also on the horizon.
Yeah, I guess like to round it out before we get to, you know, the last take home points or the kind of the end of the interview here, there's a bunch of new stuff in the pipeline. One of these is ensifentrine. It's pretty unpronounceable, but this is a...
Just a peek behind the curtain for our listeners. We do have a script that we refer to from time to time, just as a prompt, and it's even spelled out here phonetically, and I still don't know how to say that. That's far too many consonants.
I thought you were going to make fun of me for not knowing how to say it.
You're doing great, buddy. Yeah, no, I saw that spelled out, and God, like, Hawando says that, and I don't.
I tried to get ahead of it, and it didn't work.
So roflumilast is a PDE4 inhibitor, and this one is a PDE3 and PDE4 inhibitor. Why is this better? I mean, we already established that more is always better, so I guess that's why.
That's why all my COPD patients are on high doses of ICS and high doses of oral corticosteroid. Yes.
Is this the one that you were talking about you've had more luck with?
I have recently. So so caveat to this is it's expensive, so you really do need to have good insurance, unfortunately. There is though a patient assistance program out there that's active, so you have that to fall back on. But it requires a prior auth, and there are certain parameters. A patient needs to have pretty significant lung disease. I think they need to be on triple therapy, and there are several others. But yeah, so ensifentrine is it's a first-in-class medication, being a PDE3 and 4 inhibitor. It gives you combined bronchodilator and anti-inflammatory effects. And there's data from phase 3 trials, Enhance 1 and Enhance 2, that show actually an improvement in FEV1, which is great. We often don't see that. Also an improvement in respiratory symptoms and health-related quality of life. I think Enhance 2 did not have quite the significance kind of reached versus Enhance 1. But overall, we've got pretty good data, and the safety profile is also pretty favorable, with kind of side effects being comparable to placebo. And so that's huge when you think about the other options, in my opinion. The data that we have is basically, to kind of summarize it, is that with ensifentrine, we're talking about a nebulized kind of dual mechanism action agent. To be granular here, you're getting about a 90, maybe 100 cc improvement in FEV1, which is not huge, but you've got that reduction in exacerbation and improvement in quality of life and symptoms with a very reasonable safety profile. So that's why I like it as an option. And like I said, I think I need to get fact check on this. I think if the person doesn't meet criteria for ICS, then that's okay. But if they do, then they should be on triple therapy before you add it.
Mm. So for interest of time, there's multiple monoclonal antibodies that are being used. Some of these I recognize, you know, also there I are. Think are being tried in certain types of asthma. And then we have some like ablation therapies that are available, some like interventional therapies.
So very, very briefly, I'll say that dupilumab is really the one biologic that is currently available as an add-on therapy for COPD. It got that indication recently. Frankly, I think it's kind of silly, because all they basically did was like, it already has an indication for asthma, of course. And they basically were like, now we can use it for asthma COPD overlap. Yay. But like, I don't really understand how that's that much of a new indication, but it is what it is. And I imagine like mepolizumab and benralizumab will probably follow suit. The extent to which they're going to be helpful in COPD, practically speaking, is I think going to depend on where on the spectrum they are. If they're like a little bit of COPD and a lot of asthma, then I would expect them to do well. If it's the reverse, then probably not. There are a couple other monoclonal antibodies. I'm not going to talk about a lot of them. The one I'll just mention is tezepelumab, which is Tezspire. That's the trade name. That is interesting to me because it works well. It's kind of like its niche is in low T2 asthma. So folks that don't have a classic allergic profile. So right. I wonder if maybe it's going to work better in your COPD patients. More to follow on that. And then, like you said, Matt, you know, there are some kind of bleeding edge, ablative type therapies that are out there, kind of reminiscent of bronchial thermoplasty for asthma, and still very much in early studies. They not ready for prime time yet, but we'll see what the data shows at the end of the day.
It's such a seductive idea, Paul, right? That we're gonna there's this, some stuff that's causing you a problem. We're just gonna burn the hell out of it, like
just
right?
zap it.
Yeah.
It feels like it seems like it. I could see enthusiasm like chronic bronchitis, where like the mucus production is such a predominant feature. I can see. Yes. No. Mechanistically, I love the idea of like this thing is a problem, so I'm going to destroy it. Like,
yeah.
Renal
denervation. There's renal denervation. People with like sciatica or chronic back pain, whatever. They're trying to like radio frequency ablate nerves and. You know, I've yet to see one of those therapies that is just like it works really well. So I'm very skeptical of these. I hope they work because I people are suffering from this condition, but I just.
And it would be great to be able to explain something too, rather than me like, well, this blocks thymic stromal lymphopoietin. Like, I don't know what that means or how it actually helps. Like, no, we burn the bad stuff. And patients are like, oh, yeah. Sounds great.
Did you
burn the hell out of it?
Did you see, since we're short on time, I'll just bring up this useless fact. Did you see on, I'm not on like TikTok, but I imagine it's on TikTok or Instagram as well. But on YouTube, they're serving me ads. It's like, there's like some blowtorch that you can get to like burn off all the weeds that grow between the cracks in your sidewalk. And it just shows this Great. Like lady walking around, just like burning all the weeds in her sidewalk. It looks so satisfying. And then the other day I saw one in the wild. I like smelled something burning and I was like looking around and there's just this lady just like blowtorching her sidewalk. So anyway.
Just make sure to leash the dogs.
Yeah. All right. So, Cyrus, when should we refer people to you? I mean, I think we all know the Paul Williams method. As soon as you get past like the second line agent, you know, or maybe as you're ordering the second line agent, you're also referring. But when should we refer to you?
Honestly, I don't think that's a bad approach. I'll break this down simply. I would say if you're initiating double therapy or even triple therapy in accordance with GOLD, that's not, I think, terribly difficult, terribly complicated. If you have issues with adherence or questions or whatever, then sure, send those folks our way. Now, when would I really kind of push for that referral? I would say if the patient's got numerous comorbid conditions, if you identify concurrent pulmonary hypertension, other lung disease, or definitely situations where you need to up the ante and use one of those aforementioned advanced therapies. Those are definitely folks that I would like to see in my clinic.
Okay. And let's get some take-home points. This has been great. Very good like overview. Learned a lot of new stuff here and, excited to see what happens with these, ablative therapies, because that's what
yes.
I'm really, no, actually, right. I like a lot of the primary care pearls in that they're pointing out comorbidities. We were talking about, how vaccinations are probably more important maybe than inhaler therapy as far as like saving people's lives with this disease. But, what are some of the big take home points here?
Yeah. So I kind of, 3 points, I would say COPD is a ubiquitous disease. So be on the lookout. But just because it's ubiquitous, it doesn't mean that it's universally easy to manage. And so I think very reasonable to get help if you need it. I would say, primary care clinicians should definitely feel empowered to treat patients who meet criteria for COPD. And GOLD has done a really good job, I think, of making the diagnostic criteria pretty straightforward. And then on the flip side, though, if that patient's getting treated and they're not responding as you'd expect, send them to me or one of my colleagues. You'd be happy to see them. And finally, I sort of tipped my hand to this earlier. COPD, yes, it's a lung disease. I get it. I'm a lung doctor. That's not lost on me. But really, the number of comorbidities that are associated with COPD, the manifestations of the disease, it really does become a systemic disease in my eyes. I would say don't take it lightly. Don't lose sight of those comorbidities. And that cachexia, that sarcopenia, cardiovascular disease, everything else we discussed, those are really big deals. Don't let the sun set on those issues. Make sure that you have a plan in place to take care of them. That's how you do right by your patients.
And Cyrus, would you like to plug anything, maybe a podcast you're a part of or whatever else you want to plug?
I mean, yeah, we have this like bunk podcast that we started a few years ago that I can't, every time I get the opportunity, I can't thank Matt enough for kind of lighting the fire and get me to do this. But Critical Care Time is the name of the podcast. If you like this, if you like listening to me, I mean, I like listening to the sound of my own voice, so clearly. So if you like talking about pulmonary medicine, you know, we talk about pulmonary medicine on steroids. We talk about all sorts of, you know, critical care topics. We are the, you know, we're the podcast for everyone who cares for the critically ill. It's Critical Care Time. We'd love to have you listen.
Yeah. And it's Nick Mark, still the co-host, I imagine.
Yes. Nick and I are essentially work spouses now. Yeah, very progressive. We have a great time with it. It's, I think we do well. We got decent ratings. We're just kind of like eons behind the curbsiders, but
check it out, people. Two great hosts, two very smart people who know how to
thank you
make topics very digestible. So check out Critical Care Time, and we'll link to that in our show notes.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com. While you're there, it's time for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, recapping the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and we want your feedback. So send your hate mail to skcurbsiders@gmail.com, care of Paul Williams. And it also helps a lot when you rate and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. I wanted to give a special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Paul Wirtz, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Waddle runs our Patreon. Krista Chumanchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Waddle.
I've been Dr. Paul Wirtz.
And I was just thinking, you know, at this, our 500th episode, I just, as I was saying the words, I was just wondering, would it be grosser if we said a little knowledge food for your brain holes? Like, if I made a plural, would that make it worse? And I think definitively it would.
So
I'm glad we made the choice that we made. That was what that pause was all about. And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.